Voices of VR podcast.
Leila Ma, lead architect of VR and advanced rendering at AMD. And so in the past, we created Liquid VR about a year ago and have been basically pushing that out to production. We're actually getting ready to have asynchronous time warp eventually come out with an Oculus SDK update. Working with Valve right now on direct to display and that kind of stuff. And Oculus actually pushed that out publicly. I think it was like a month and a half, 2 months ago. So that's been kind of the production stuff we've been doing. And of course, we're working on future stuff as well. So Liquid VR 2.0 kind of stuff. I can kind of hint that we're looking at things like, you know, audio and visual stuff, you know, cameras and lots of other pieces of the VR puzzle that we haven't addressed so far.
Great. So how do you describe what Liquid VR is doing and, you know, what the problem is that it's trying to solve?
It's pretty simple. I mean, basically, you know, when we came up with it, it was, you know, comfort, compatibility, and content were like the three things that we came up with to begin with. Was when you plug in a VR headset a year ago, you have no real guarantee it's not going to crash your system, or a lot of times it would cause it to not start on reboot, or the drivers wouldn't work properly. You know, the experience wasn't always guaranteed to be good. So that's the compatibility piece. We wanted to solve that by basically saying, okay, when you plug in a VR headset, you're not going to see a desktop. Why do I want to see a 2D Windows desktop on my face? It doesn't work. So we took that part out with direct-to-display. We also, you know, added like ways to do front buffer rendering to reduce latency, asynchronous compute to do asynchronous time warp to, again, reduce perceived motion to photon latency. That starts to get into the comfort part. So we want people to not puke on their keyboards. And, you know, that's some of the things that we did to address that, as well as, you know, latest data latch was another piece of reducing latency to improve comfort. And then the last piece was content. You know, we wanted people to be able to create better content, not have to wait around for a new GPU to be able to get, you know, that next edge on the content. So by adding Affinity Multi-GPU, you could have two GPUs or four GPUs. And for example, Valve actually has a version of their Aperture demo that supports four GPUs. So that enables, you know, content developers to sort of push the envelope of what's possible and not have to wait another year or two for us and NVIDIA to release a new card, particularly for development. If you're working on, you know, the next gen thing and you want it to be like, you know, a top tier demo a year from now, 2 years from now, how do you develop that on existing hardware if you want to max out 2 years from now hardware? So multi-GPU lets you do that.
And so when you're doing benchmarking for, you know, even internally, you know, what are the type of specifications that you look at in terms of knowing that this card is going to be able to drive a good VR experience?
It's really complex right now because things change all the time. And it's not so much like one card is good for this level of VR and, you know, one CPU is good for this level of VR, because individual developers, you know, what they choose to do, you could have, you know, something that it works great one day and then some artist came along and put in more fish and suddenly, you know, the simulation cost goes higher and you're dropping frames. So our main goal is really just don't drop any frames, right? It's not frames per second anymore. You know, 200 frames per second doesn't give you a better VR experience than 90. You really just want to have 90 and always have 90 and always deliver the exact frame rate you need. And in fact, if you could run 200 frames per second, what you'd want to do is start your frame later so that you're still doing 90 frames per second, but you're actually lowering your motion to photon latency because you've grabbed your input and created your image out of it in a shorter period of time. So that's what we look for, is ways to just maintain comfort, maintain that bar of minimum performance, which it's really just an on or off. You know, it's like, are you dropping frames or not? And then from there, increase content quality with the rest. That's what we're looking at in terms of performance.
And what are the biggest trade-offs that you have to make in terms of dialing something back and then in order to increase, you know, something else? Like when you're looking at, and engineering is all about like having constraints and you can't have everything. So what are the biggest kind of trade-offs that you have to make?
So, I mean, mostly that's not us doing it. That's the content developer's choice. But yeah, I mean, we look at things like, for example, foveated rendering is something we're looking at. So the current lenses on these VR headsets are very bad around the periphery. You know, for every like 4, 8, 10, 12 pixels, depending on the optics, you might actually see just a blob that's a combination of all of them, and it's kind of very low quality. So why do you want to render all those pixels at the same quality as what you're seeing in the fovea, where actually the lenses are much clearer? So that's one thing that we can do that's not necessarily the content developers, but it's on us to release mechanisms by which they can easily say, okay, we're going to optimize the amount of rendering and amount of computation we do to create basically an image that looks the same after the optics get in the way, but the input, we're not wasting so much time in places you won't see it. So we are really working a lot on those areas. And then, you know, we advise content developers a lot. So we work with major game studios and content studios, and we do have labs, and we look at, you know, the content they're creating, and sometimes we'll say, well, look, you know, in this place, you know, you had this huge explosion and you started juddering, you dropped some frames, and we'd try to help them figure out what it was in the GPU pipeline or the CPU pipeline that actually caused that problem and how they can address it.
Yeah, and it seems like the GPUs are really kind of the heart of virtual reality experiences. And so from you, when did you first get into this VR world with this kind of latest revolution of consumer VR?
Well, I mean, you know, it depends what you look at. I've been doing the rendering stuff that applies to VR since like 2004. You know, nobody really knew what VR was yet, and I wasn't necessarily focused on VR, but I was solving the same problems that VR needs solved. And, you know, about 4 years ago, you know, really kicked some of that into high gear. And, you know, then the consumer headsets start to be a thing when Oculus was, you know, purchased by Facebook. That was when suddenly everybody said, oh gosh, this actually is happening this time. And so from there, that's where actually AMD as a company started to, I think, see the value a lot more. And started to see, okay, this isn't just something that, you know, somebody's working on a garage, but this is something that's going to transform the world, and we need to get ahead of it. And that was, you know, from there is eventually we created basically a VR team, and I became the lead architect of that team. You know, my boss came to me and said, I want to move fast on this, and, you know, I think you're the right person. So basically from there it became more official, but really, you know, we've been working on the same kind of ideas for many years, and it was just a matter of now there's the budget to formalize them into products like Liquid VR.
And what was you said you were working back in like 2004 on the same, like what were those things?
Okay, yeah, I've been doing graphics research. You know, I started in 2004 in graphics research. Basically, one of the problems that VR has, that still has, is that we are really brute forcing a lot of things. So something I've been working on for many years is the alternative approach. How do we not actually pretend that every frame is almost, you know, a separate thing from the one before it, but how do we find coherence between them, and how do we optimize, you know, rendering and stuff like that? So my work since before I was even at AMD has been along that thread of efficiency, and all of that applies really naturally to VR because VR ups the number of frames that we create per second. HTC Vive and CV1 are going to be 90 frames per second, but that's 2i, so it's 180 images per second. And that's at, you know, around 2160 by 1200 is the resolution. So, you know, that's quite a lot of data that you're pushing there, a lot of pixels you're pushing. When you go to 4K or 8K, you know, the numbers just explode. And so eventually the way that we're doing rendering now isn't sustainable. And, you know, my expertise has actually been in solving the problem of how do we transition to a more sustainable way of doing it. So,
yeah, it sounds like quite a paradigm shift. So what does that look like?
I don't know how much I can actually say at this point, but I think it, you know, it looks like, for example, you look at CRTs. CRTs are why we have scan lines now. You know, CRTs actually had a beam and it went across the screen and back over, and it actually scanned out pixels. And LCDs have kind of evolved from that display technology, and so they continue to do that scan raster pattern. In reality, a lot of that has been engineered into the cable specifications, you know, HDMI and DisplayPort. Like, there is a lot of technology that relies on that now. So it's not just that you could do away with it. But over time, there is the question of really why do we still do it this way? So I am looking, you know, at things like that, for example, at, you know, what are the right ways to do this? The real world actually just has a bunch of photons bouncing around, and eventually some of them hit your eye. And they don't all hit your eye at one point in time, like a frame. They hit your eye just whenever they come in. So, for example, why are we not looking to build displays that function more along those lines? You know, I can't exactly say what I'm doing, but those are kind of the directions that you might look in.
I see. Well, I just did an interview with Tom Furness talking about, you know, virtual retina displays and digital light field technologies. So,
yeah, light field is one of the main things that, you know, I think over the next 10 years is going to transform the way that we do rendering in VR.
Yeah.
And that's definitely something I'm working on. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, it seems like, I mean, also just, you know, it just seems more natural. And so have you got to try out the Magic Leap technology then?
Actually, I haven't. I was supposed to go down there a few weeks ago, but I've just been traveling so much lately that I haven't had the chance to try it. but I can imagine it's pretty cool. From what I've read of the patents and stuff, I kind of have an idea of how it works. And I think their biggest problem at the moment is going to be both field of view, because, you know, waveguides are hard, and then also they probably have to do actually a lot more rendering than traditional approaches do. And so they're facing an even harder problem in some sense than Oculus and Valve are facing in terms of the brute force overhead.
Now, when it comes to adding multiple GPUs, how do you sync? What are the biggest problems when you're going from just one GPU to, you know, adding multiple ones?
It's a challenge. If you're talking about, you know, traditional rendering, what we did for games on a 2D screen was this kind of brute force thing where we said one GPU will render the current frame and the next GPU will render the frame after that. And so there's not a lot of dependency traditionally between those frames. That's actually changed recently as temporal AA and other effects have come in that actually link the multiple frames together. But that was sort of an easy brute force way to do it, because each two frames are probably very similar. So the two GPUs are doing roughly a similar workload and they don't actually have to share a lot of data between them. When you get to VR, that paradigm doesn't work, because latency is one of the most important things. If you have high motion to photon latency, your brain will perceive that as, you know, you might be poisoned or something, so you get sick. So in VR, we do something with Affinity Multi-GPU. One of the ways we do it is slice up the screen into subsections, and each GPU handles a piece of the screen. You know, our API is quite easy. It's intuitive to do that, but it's extra work for the developer, something they didn't have to do before. And the more you slice and dice, the more inefficiency there is in having to send all those commands and all the data, you know, through the driver layers and duplicate things, you know, for example, geometry across multiple places. There's an overlap potentially, and geometry might actually hit three or four different slices if those slices get small enough, right? You might have a triangle that spans multiple slices, and that triangle then has to be replicated on multiple GPUs, and all the work has to be done multiple times. So there's diminishing returns to that screen space slicing and dicing when you're talking about multiple physical GPUs. But something you could imagine is, if you rather than had multiple GPUs in multiple sockets, if eventually you got to what single chip that looked a lot more like lots of tiny little GPUs on that chip, and the interconnect between them was really fast, then some of this overhead would naturally kind of go away. And you could move things into where they need to be, and the data movement would be low, and the power could be better. So the paradigm itself is not an untenable one, but it is untenable when you're across a PCI Express bus, you know, with multiple discrete GPUs. If you try to go to like 16 of them, the overheads of transferring data around are going to usurp your actual benefits. So architectural changes will really be needed to continue down that path. But then there are also other ways to do multi-GPU. So for example, you could have one GPU that's just rendering the frames, creating the images that the eyes see, or two of them. And you could have another GPU doing physics, another GPU doing audio, another GPU doing, you know, bouncing light around the scene like global illumination, or four of them bouncing light around the scene. And those could actually be doing ray tracing while you're doing rasterization to your final image. So there are ways to scale, but again, these actually require dramatic changes to the way engines are built. And currently, most engines aren't prepared to really go this broad with, you know.
You mean like the Unity or Unreal Engine? Is that what you mean?
Unity and Unreal at the moment are not at all architected to just take advantage of all these different GPUs and to scale. You know, if you had 16 GPUs, they just wouldn't know what to do with it. They don't have a way to utilize them. And if they did, you know, the first way they might do it is that naive sort of dicing up the scene way, which becomes very inefficient. So if you want to then start doing what you could do and dicing up, you know, different pieces of the world like the audio to another GPU, that takes additional work and it takes new software paradigms that they have not yet gotten to. I think that's, you know, what we're going to see happening over the next 5 to 10 years is these kind of advances so that we can actually scale out. Because another problem in manufacturing is actually making really big GPU cores, you know, 600 square millimeter GPUs, the yields are lower, you know, you have errors that actually causes, you know, some of the GPU to not be viable. If you could make lots of smaller chips and then put them on a substrate together, for example, you know, you could get higher yields. It wouldn't cost you as much to build a chip. You could build lots of small ones and put them together. And then if the software paradigms actually get to the point of allowing you to distribute your workloads like this, that could be a great way forward in terms of actually getting more computation for less money and less power.
So how would you sort of combine the output of all these 16 GPUs? I mean, there seems to be like you would have to fuse all that data together somehow.
That's actually where the inefficiency comes in as well. Is, you know, if all 16 GPUs are dicing up a picture, now you've got to transfer the results from each one back to one unifying image. Unless you have 16 separate outputs, which no current headset has, right? They're all one or two cables. So again, what you would do here, if you had like audio processing on one GPU, and you know, that actually could have an output to an audio jack, right? And so you wouldn't need to recombine it with the visuals. If you had physics on one GPU, you know, physics might be tolerant to more latency than the rendering is. So you could actually potentially have the physics data a half a frame behind or something, and then it transfers some data back to the main GPU, like the quaternions of here's the new location and rotation of this object or stuff like that. So the data you'd have to send wouldn't be as much as the data you needed for computation. And there are ways to make that kind of a system work. But it is a lot of elaborate software engineering, so it's going to take time to get there.
Yeah, I'm really getting how there's so many bottlenecks of, like, you're really kind of ahead of the, you're really the heart of VR, but also ahead of where a lot of the technology is really at to be able to even use it. So it seems like a interesting design problem to be designing for the future that doesn't exist yet.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, who has 16 GPUs in a computer? Maybe people doing supercomputing work, but not most consumers. So there's a point of convergence, and if we hit it right, then the software could kind of be developed in parallel with the hardware, and they could come to market at the same time. That's not how things have traditionally happened, except with maybe console world. So it's really interesting to watch that and say, well, what's the chicken and the egg? Normally a hardware company won't build the hardware until the software is ready kind of to support that hardware, and vice versa. The software companies don't want to change their engines for something, you know, that 16 GPUs or something that doesn't exist yet in commodity, you know, out in the consumer marketplace. So we know where we want to get to, but actually getting over the chicken and the egg problem is hard. And it might take some people taking leaps to really get us there quicker.
Yeah, and it seems like, I mean, I don't know, potentially if digital light fields could, you know, since it's shooting photons, it's less, more replicating how light is naturally hitting our eyes. And so you'd have potentially the possibility, I would think, to maybe operate in parallel a little bit more than having to fuse the data back into a single unified sort of display.
Yeah, light field is interesting. And, you know, like you talk about path tracing or ray tracing, I mean, rendering is already a very parallel, embarrassingly parallel problem, and that kind of stuff still is. There are still issues to write a really good path tracer that's distributed, but people have done it. I mean, there are companies already which have produced path tracers that scale out to thousands of GPUs in a cluster. One thing about that is it's still a very brute force approach typically. So, you know, something that I think we need to see over the next coming years is getting away from the brute force of just sending, you know, random rays everywhere like the world does, because that's ground truth. That's what actually happens. But if you want to do that, you're probably like 5 million X performance away from where we want to be if we want to have a mobile device having this level of quality eventually. You're probably more like 5,000x away from that goal if you kind of take some of the hacks the game industry has always done with graphics, you know, where we say, yes, there's the mathematical correct version, but then we just want to have the one that looks really good. It might not be mathematically true, but most people won't be able to tell the difference. If we can get to that where we're having a similar quality, it's not correct and it's not perfect, but we're taking advantage of a lot of those shortcuts and those ways that we can exploit how actually human perception is not perfect, then I think we're going to get somewhere much sooner. Like in our lifetimes, we'll be able to see something that's photorealistic, at least, you know, to the limits of our perception. It won't be right. It won't be real, but it might fool us. And I'd like that to be the path that we go down.
Yeah, at GTC this year, AMD was in the talks about Vulkan. And talk a bit about the importance of Vulkan in terms of kind of creating these open standards within the graphics industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Vulkan is amazingly important, and that, you know, of course, that came out of Mantle, kind of like Liquid VR. But Liquid VR is actually not something that AMD wants to be. You know, we don't want to have a proprietary API for VR. We just wanted to see the industry get where it needed to be, and so Liquid VR was in a way like Mantle. It was like, let's solve these problems. We see the problems. We know how to solve them. Let's solve them. We can solve them very quickly, and then the industry will pick up those solutions. You know, Microsoft now in their next release is going to have an actual first-class citizen version of direct-to-display. So, you know, the Windows itself will get rid of the desktop. It won't have a desktop on an HMD, and that's a great thing to see. You know, we don't want to be actually the ones that have to do that forever. We want to see it happen in the OS where it should. So, you know, it's really exciting to see Vulkan come out of the ashes of Mantle, so to speak. I mean, Mantle is still something we use in research at AMD. It's not dead. But as a consumer product, Vulkan is what we see as the way forward because it's an open standard. You know, it's part of Kronos. It's developed, you know, it was started from Mantle, but then the whole industry had their insight and their additions and modifications to it so that it's something that everybody sort of agreed upon as the way forward. And at the same time, you know, it works across all different platforms, smartphones and Linux and, you know, macOS. So it's, I think, a great thing that we've sort of been able to at least take that next step forward in graphics API design. And it only does solve, you know, a few problems, a few major problems that there were with the old APIs. So I think, you know, Vulkan is not the end either. You know, there will be a Vulkan 2 or something like that after that will address even further limitations or, you know, inefficiencies in the APIs. But it's great to see us getting there as an industry.
Yeah, that's the thing that's striking to me is that just the, in order for VR to succeed, that there's a, probably a little bit more collaboration that we may see if there was a little bit more of a, like perhaps in the 90s, it was a little bit more competitive in different ways. And so from your perspective, what have you been surprised about in terms of the types of collaborations that AMD has had with, say, an NVIDIA in terms of making VR successful?
I would say, unfortunately, I don't think there's been any collaboration. And I think you're right. What's best for the industry would be to see us both aligning more. For example, a lot of times AMD will put a new graphics feature in our hardware, and then NVIDIA will put a different version in their hardware. And we're kind of generally trying to solve the same problems, but oftentimes we end up with different implementations of those solutions. And sometimes they're so close that they would almost work together, but they're just slightly different. And so in the end, people actually writing, you know, game engines and such are left with a problem. Do I implement AMD's version? Do I implement NVIDIA's version? Do I implement both? Or do I just forget about this until later when it actually becomes a standard feature that is the same on both? And oftentimes that's what happens. Oftentimes, until a feature is standard, it won't actually get ubiquitous adoption. And so it would be, in some sense, wonderful if we could actually take the hardware engineering architecture design process and get consensus before we build some of these features between the two companies. Unfortunately, the competition between the two has been largely based on, well, how are we different and how are we exclusively better, rather than, you know, trying to have a unified thing that we both just try to optimize for. And that's sort of a business problem that I don't know that I can fix, but I think we probably all lament the situation. In some sense, our competition strives us both to be better. And of course, if AMD or NVIDIA didn't exist, I don't think we'd be where we were today if only one of the two companies existed, because there wouldn't have been that push to keep getting better. But at the same time, there is so much that we could do if we actually did, in some senses, collaborate as well as compete. It would be a great thing to see. I mean, AMD, for our part, is trying to do this by we're opening up, you know, a lot of our stuff. We put all of our ISA documents about our GPU instruction set. We're putting most of our GPU documents, the actual architecture documents, out publicly so that developers can read them, understand them. You know, the PlayStation, the Xbox, the, you know, Nintendo console are all based on our architecture. And so there's a lot of opportunity there for people to do open things and really, you know, innovate on this architecture and learn about architecture and contribute back to us what would they like to see in a future version, because hey, they know how it works and they're like, well, if it worked just this little bit differently, you know, this would be better, and they'll tell us something like that, and oftentimes, you know, we'll do what we can to make that happen. Unfortunately, on the NVIDIA side, we don't get to see the documents and developers don't get to see the documents, so it's hard. If they would go open as well, I mean, I think that could be an amazing thing for the industry. And if there was just, you know, x86, for example, is an open spec. It's got a license, but it's, you know, everybody can implement it in terms of knowing how it works. And I think in some sense, that's done a lot for CPUs because, you know, an AMD or an Intel, you plug them in, they just run the same code. There's no driver for a CPU. It would be nice to see drivers for GPUs eventually become less of a bottleneck.
And finally, what do you see as kind of the ultimate potential of virtual reality and what it might be able to enable?
Oh my gosh, this is, I mean, everything. I can't think of an industry or a piece of human life that VR doesn't have the potential to touch. Unfortunately, it will also, you know, it will touch humans in bad ways, as most technologies do. But I'm really, really excited about all the potential good ways that VR can change human civilization. You know, for example, education. Can you imagine, you know, being able to, let's pretend you want to know how a jet engine works. You could read a book, or you could now go into VR and you could actually start like taking the engine apart and, you know, looking at the internal, seeing how each piece works, and then sort of jumping from portal to portal as you do with hyperlinks in the internet to, you know, all the different pieces of information related to that. There's, I mean, I could go on for hours literally about and in every space, you know, medical and social and all of these different things, increasing empathy, you know, bringing people who are very distant, you know, live across the world from each other, you know, closer, like what Chris Milk did with the whole Syrian refugee camp thing. You know, he's able to actually bring people who would never probably personally be able to set foot in that environment. It's not the same thing, but they got to be closer to that experience, and that gave them the ability to maybe empathize with those people on a level that they couldn't really attain before. If we can do things like that, imagine what it could do for preventing wars. And I mean, it's the potential is really limitless, and I'm super excited about it.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. If you'd like to support the Voices of VR podcast, then please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/voicesofvr.